Hello, I'm Michael Cantrell, and you are listening to the Prison Officer Podcast, a place to have a conversation about the forgotten cops that work in this country's jails, prisons, and correctional centers. A place for me to try to make sense of a career spent working inside the fence with some of the greatest people that nobody sees or recognizes for the important job they do to keep this world safe. If you love this podcast, hit the follow button, or better yet, share with your family, friends, or coworkers. In more than 28 years of corrections, I have used or supervised pepperball hundreds of times. Now, as a master instructor for pepperball, I teach others about the versatility and effectiveness of this pepperball system. From cell extractions to disturbances on the rec yard, pepperball is the first option in my correctional toolbox. One of the most dangerous times for officers is during cell extractions. Pepperball allows officers to respond with the lowest level of force and still be effective and ready if the situation escalates. The responding officer controls where the projectiles are aimed, how many projectiles are launched, and how rapidly they're deployed. This allows the response to be tailored to the moment. To learn more about Pepperball, go to www.pepperball.com or click the link below in the show's information guide. Pepperball is the safer option first. Okay, well, welcome back to the Prison Officer Podcast. And thank you, John, for coming on the podcast. So I always like to start at the beginning. Tell me a little bit about, you know, where you grew up and how you got into corrections. How did that come about?
I was born and raised up in Northern Ohio, and in 1975, the place I was working at got laid off during the time as everything was going downhill. So I enlisted in the United States Army and got up to Sergeant First Class E7. And my military MOS, which was nuclear weapons, had kind of went out the window with SALT II. And I was kind of wanting to get a career change and everything like that. So at that time, I had been working part-time on the City of Dixon Police Department as a deputy marshal, and kind of liked the law enforcement. It was something different and everything. And one of the individuals I went to church with had worked at Algoa Correctional Center, and he had was telling me about it, and he said, oh, yeah, it's a pretty easy laid-back job and everything like that. And I tried for a couple of things. I was a little bit too old to get on the highway patrol at that time. And so the city didn't really offer me very much in the way of benefits or anything. So I took the test for Department of Corrections. And before the month was out, I received notification to report up to Fulton Reception Diagnostic Center in Fulton, Missouri. And that's where I started my career at.
So for those that don't know, what is Fulton Diagnostic and Reception Center? What do they do there?
Fulton Reception Diagnostic Center, or FRDC, is when an individual is sentenced to serve time in the Missouri Department of Corrections, the counties will bring them up to diagnostic centers, and at that time they'll be in processed. They'll go through all different kinds of diagnostic testing. Mental health, they'll do blood work on them to determine if they have any illnesses. People will be really surprised on how many people come through and are identified as being active tuberculosis or TB. Wow. And they'll start processing some and trying to figure out, you know, if they need any type of like schooling or anything like that. And if some people need like to complete a GED. And they'll look at a lot of different things to come up with, one, how many years are they doing, two, if they need any type of specialized assistance later on, age. There's a lot of different factors that go into it, and then they finally come up with a determination that this individual will be going to this institution, or, you know, and it could be from a level one, which is a low institutions, up to a five, which is maximum security. And that could take anywhere between, you know, a couple months, 2 to 3 months. And once then their determination where they're going to, then they'll be transported to that institution.
Yeah. I think that's one of the misconceptions that the public has, and the media doesn't help that, that we just grab these inmates and we just throw them all in one big place together. There's a lot of thought, a lot of, like you said, diagnostic testing that goes on to figure out where to place this inmate, where he's going to do the best and where other inmates are going to be safe and where he can be controlled in some cases. But the programming, you know, they send them to the places where they can get what they need to have that chance not to come back to prison.
Yeah. There's one thing that has started within the last started at MSP, and a lot of the institutions are picking up now, is what is called the ITC program, which is Intensive Therapeutic Community, which is where they basically are all in. And it's helped the ones that had been like in foreign drugs and everything, to help them break the drug habit or other habits like that. Like I said, it started there at MSP and has grown to all the institutions in the state. There are some individuals nowadays that get sentenced to 180 days to go through the ITC program. If they complete the program, then they can get out on parole. If they don't complete it, then they have to complete their sentence. So, okay. Wow. Like I said, yeah, wow. It's definitely a diagnostic program.
And how long were you there?
I was there about 16 months. There was like two other individuals that started up there, and we were both all from the same area. And so we was able to carpool. For us, it was a distance about 75 miles one way. And finally, one of them, the older guy, he transferred down to Missouri State Penitentiary, which knocked off about 25 miles one way. And shortly after he left, I went ahead and decided, it was like, hey, I need to get a little bit closer to home. So I put in to transfer to MSP. And that was one of those things, if you put a transfer in MSP, it took about 2 seconds for you to be approved and told to report there within the next minute, you know. So, but then that's how I ended up, it, you know, the old walls is what they wanted to call it. So,
yeah. So at what point in your career did you start thinking about advancement? Was that early on in the career? Did you know you were going to try to promote like you had in the military?
I mean, that was one of the things, was like, that was always in the military. You know, you always, you know, kept wanting to advance. And I guess also too, you know, as military, was that they had done away with the, you know, the old professional PFC. You know, the guy had been in the Army 20 years as a PFC. You know, they had it, whereas if you didn't advance, you would eventually be, you know, eliminated from service. So, and on top of that, it was, it, I guess it was just me. I just wanted to start advancing. And so, like I said, when I got at MSP, you know, that, of course, back then you had a, it was a little bit different process. You had the merit system and everything, and you had to get your points and stuff like that. And so, but then I started, you know, looking in to be promoted to sergeant.
So what was that road like? Did they give you a chance to go work in the jobs first?
No, they basically was, since I came from, you know, from the diagnostic center, they assumed that, you know, I was already a seasoned officer. So I got there and was assigned to housing unit 3B the first day, and just started working there. I worked on there for a while, and then I had a couple other different jobs, and I ended up as a utility officer. And utility, you know, you did everything and worked everywhere, which was beneficial to me later on in my career, because, you know, when you worked all the different units and all the different housing units later on, as a supervisor, you could, you know, step in and you could work there. Did a lot of transportation, did a lot of transporting of inmates, did several high, what they call high profile transports. You know, so all of it was kind of like a, I don't know, I guess it would be looked at getting ready for the next position. And I put in for sergeant. When I was promoted to sergeant, I started out working at the control center relief sergeant. I would work two evenings and then 2 days. And one thing that benefited me a little bit was, in, up in Fulton, they did all their chronological reports for the housing units on the computer. Got to MSP, everything was by handwritten. And when I got in the control center, all the reports were handwritten. Well, a lot of them was like came to work, counted, and went home. You know, there was nothing else in between. So I started trying to come up with the same format they used up there in Fulton. And I did it, and the deputy warden we had at that time, he really liked it because I could email it to him. And then the next morning when he came in, he could take a look and see what happened on shift. Took a little bit, but then it finally got approved, and I would start using it. Then eventually other people started using it, and it was kind of a benefit. Later on, the evening shift sergeant retired, and then I went full-time evening shift as a control center sergeant.
Yeah.
You know.
Kind of bringing in, you know, MSP was always kind of slow to take on new technologies and stuff. And, you know, you started at Fulton, and then you said you went into 3A or 3B, whichever.
3B.
But those are lever halls. And a lot of people don't even know what lever halls are anymore.
Actually, 3A and B.
Had they switched over then?
They switched over to switches. And 2A and B and 5A and B was lever halls. That was a different thing. I mean, you go in there, and they put me over there one day as a utility officer, and I'm over there fighting with those levers, and I was about ready to break the lever off the wall. And an inmate came up, and they used to have inmates run the levers. And he said, okay, what you got to do is, you know, if you're opening this cell, go up a little bit. Now, can you feel that? And it was like a, you know, you had to have that definite touch. You know, you could feel it just kind of fall into place, and then you could sleeve it. After you learned the grip, it was nothing. I mean, you go in there, and you would start opening cells and everything. It was not a problem. And 5A and B was the same way. You know, they were both lever halls. And then, like I said, 3A and B was switches. So it was a little bit different, a little bit better.
They had switched over. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It probably surprises some people to hear that the inmates touched the levers, but, you know, inmates did a lot of stuff that you wouldn't expect. We had count clerks at that time.
Yeah. We did too.
Put all the count together. And tell us a little bit about that.
Had one time, it was kind of funny. We was doing count on evening shift, and this one housing unit kept coming up wrong. And so finally they came up and they called in the right count, because I was on the desk. And I asked them, I says, what was the problem? And the officer said, well, the inmate clerk told us this inmate was still out on a trip. And I was like, so I called the captain. I said, Cap, here's what we got. You want to clear the count? No. So he sent some other people over, and they counted it. Shortly after that, it's basically all the inmate clerks for the housing units went. Now, they still had some like down in food service and places like that, but they did paperwork. They didn't have anything to do with the count or anything like that. So, yeah, it was a different world back then.
It's quite amazing. It really was. I think back on some of that stuff, and I'm like, I can't even imagine running a prison like that these days, but we did.
Yeah.
We sure did. So you make sergeant, you're in a leadership position now. So tell me some of the challenges and, you know, leadership tips that you learned during that time.
I looked at, to me, people ask me about your leadership style. My leadership style was based upon what I observed other people in leadership positions. And I always would try to figure out their strengths and their weaknesses, what they did right, what they did wrong. And then I would come up with my own. If they were doing something to me that was totally wrong, then I learned from that. I was like, no, you don't do that. If they were doing something right, then it's kind of like, okay, you kind of learn from them. And it was just a constant learning curve. You know, I mean, you always wanted to look at and trying to figure out how you could do things better, how you could impact people. One thing that I learned, you know, way back when, it was, you know, the ability to talk and listen to people. There was a lot of times just talking to somebody, you could diffuse the situation. You know, you just, Right. You know, and that's both true with staff and inmates, you know, so sure. I guess that's about the best thing I can say, just, you know.
Well, I like the way you say, learn how to talk and listen to people, because a lot of people, they just get the one side of that. You know, they think communication's talking, but communication is doing as much listening, if not more, than you do talk. And that's a hard thing for some new supervisors to learn. Absolutely. So it's interesting you said that.
Well, I'll give you a little bit of an example. Later on, when I'd made lieutenant, sure. One of the jobs I had, I was ADSEG lieutenant in 3C&D, which was the old death row. At that time, now it switched over to ADSEG. And I was doing my rounds, and there was one inmate, and he just, you know, I stopped, and he wanted to start talking. And he just, I mean, he went on a rant for about 5 minutes, just telling me everything. You know, I'm just standing there listening to him and everything, because open bar cells.
Right.
And he got all done, and I told him, I said, you know, man, I said, there's not much I can really do for you. And he looked at me and he says, mm-hmm. No, you did. You stood here and listened to me. He said, I appreciate that.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, you know, granted, I couldn't help him, but the biggest thing I did was be able to listen to him. And, you know, and that's what he wanted, somebody just to listen to him so he could get it off his chest. You know.
It's what a lot of people want. I know people who pay good money to go see a therapist who will just listen to them. You know, that's what a lot of people need. So you made it to lieutenant. Now, I'm just going to tell you my, I guess, my impressions of that time period, which I was at MSP 90, end of 91 through 93. So we crossed over there. But a lieutenant at Missouri State Penn was God. A captain was one step above God, you know. So what was that like, being a lieutenant at the walls? Because you guys were looked up to. I mean, whenever something went wrong, everybody looked to you.
I'll give you a little bit of a funny story. After I'd been on control center desk for a couple of years, and, you know, Chris, whenever you got made a phone, you know, radio call was always station one. And shortly after I made lieutenant, I was down in the main dining room, and there was a fight breakout. Well, you know, instead of using my radio number, I went at station one. So there for a while, they was calling me mobile station one, because it took a little bit to break that, you know, because you were used to just saying station one all the time, you know, so it took a while to get used to what my radio number was. But I started out again as utility. I worked on evening shift, and, you know, you had, you know, different zones and everything else like that. And, you know, you started stepping up. You know, that's where you started really getting into the more of dealing with both staff and the offenders on a, you know, different type of level. You know, it was just one of those things. And then from there, I went to day shift, you know, utility lieutenant, and then we got a new major came in. And eventually I ended up working down in the property room after ADSEG. I was in ADSEG for a couple of years, worked in the property room. And again, this was another one of those things that unless you ever worked in the property room, you never really understood all of it. And it was another one of those things, as, you know, another step up, gave me the insight to what it was like to deal with the property and everything, and why property was important, why you had to make sure the inventory was done right and everything like that. And eventually, you know, I transferred out of that, and there for a while I was doing time and attendance. And the major we had, he was leaving, and I asked if I said, you know, if I could go down. And the last I worked down in food service, you know, again, this was another one of those things that was a little bit different. And you know what it was like down there in the main dining room. There'd be times that me and one of my CO1s, we'd be standing in the middle of the dining room, standing back to back, having full-blown conversations. Now, most people think it was like, well, if you're having a conversation with somebody, you had to maintain that eye-to-eye contact. We didn't. I mean, I'd be looking one way, he'd be looking the other way, and we'd be having conversations. And one of us say, hey, I got something over here, and then we just peel off and take care of it. But, you know, people would look at us, and they're like, you guys are having a conversation standing back to back. It was like, yeah, we had to. You know, you couldn't maintain that.
Right.
It wasn't politically correct, but it was survival talk. You know, we had to deal with it that way.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, but.
Yeah, dining room was one of the dangerous places. I remember the ramp that went into the dining room there, and you just, whenever you watched that ramp, you were kind of by yourself. They couldn't see you from the inside, and the guys in main corridor couldn't see you, and it was a dangerous place to be. You know,
because a lot of times they put you out there by yourself and tell you to pat search. You know, but right. Eventually they put the cameras in. That did cameras helped a lot. You know, but you know, there was one time. It's like, well, I was evening shift lieutenant. I was down there, and we had word that the BGD Crips and Bloods were going to have a large fight. And I seen this one guy break and run, so mm-hmm. I knew what it was. So I called it. Me and two other officers took him down. And afterwards, I'm kneeling on the floor of the dining room, kind of like shaking my head, like, what the heck's going on? I look up, the whole dining room's fighting. So I was getting ready to call 10-5, mm-hmm. and then somebody else did. So I got back up, and we started, you know, dealing with everything. And later on that night, it was in the wintertime, and I had a black jacket on, and somebody looked at me and said, hey, LT, what's that on your jacket? And I looked on my jacket, and right across my jacket on a 45-degree angle was a perfect imprint of a Converse tennis shoe. I got kicked in the chest, and it knocked me out.
Well,
but
yeah.
The thing of it was, is there was no cameras down there, so the paperwork for that night was kind of like, yeah, we had a large fight, and yeah, I pepper sprayed some inmates. I don't know who they were. And yeah, I did this and I did that. And you couldn't tell because there was no way of knowing it, because, you know, you'd grab somebody and pull them off one inmate fighting and put them off the side, have some, you know, it was chaos. And it, we got out of there that night. There's, you know, but it was all good, I guess.
Yeah, I've described it to people that when, you know, I would respond to the dining room, you'd go in there and it looked like a Beetle Bailey cartoon. You remember those where there was just like a ball of people and there'd be an arm and a leg and sticking out from the side? You didn't know what belonged to who, you know, when some of those fights would kick off. But yeah, we watched each other's back. I've told people before that, you know, one of the most dangerous places I've ever worked, and I worked at some other penitentiaries, was Missouri State Pen. But I never felt that it was as dangerous because of the way we watched each other. There was a camaraderie there that I never saw again. That's the good memory I have about the place.
Yeah. And there was a couple officers that when something happened, they would kind of go the other way. But what was always amazing was that night, later that night after that, we had a couple of the other inmates come up from other organizations, and they told us, you know, that, hey, we just want to let you know we got our people out of there, which was good. And they said, your officers did really good. And then they also said that there was a couple of the officers had ran out of the dining room. And, you know, they wouldn't tell us who, but then, you know, shortly after that, you figured it out because the way they started dealing with it, because they felt it was like, if the officers did not back their own, then they sure in the heck wasn't going to help them when they were in a bad situation. So,
right.
Yeah, it was, you know, it didn't matter how big or bad you were. I always told officers was, I just want to know how much heart you had. If you had the heart to jump in the middle of a fight, get thrown out, jump back in, then I'd rather have that person than somebody that was big and strong and didn't want to fight. No, I was going to say the ones that always scared me the most were the ones that said, I can't wait for my first fight. Because you don't know what you're going to do until you're put in that situation. You know, so.
Yeah, and your first fight at MSP could be any type of weapon. It could be, it could be big gang fights. It could be disturbance on the yard. So you never wished for anything.
No.
Because you didn't know how bad that was going to be.
Yeah.
I always said you could tell who had been involved in those fights before by how fast they ran to somebody else's fight. Because usually they might go a little slower until they'd been at the bottom of that dog pile, and it seemed like an hour before help got to you. And then when next time it was their turn to run, they were running, you know?
Yeah. It was big something that was then. Different. Yeah. You know, it was the biggest thing was we always had each other six. And that yes. was the biggest thing. We had to have each other six, you know?
Yeah. And I always felt that up there.
Yeah,
I did. So when did you make captain?
I made
captain. That was your next step?
That was my next step. At that time, it was in the process of getting ready to, they were building the new institution by that time. And it was starting getting ready to build and everything. And you know, we'd go out there and kind of take a look at the new institution and everything. And of course, you know, there was a couple of us, and I was one of them. We was in on the planning of moving of MSP. That was one of the things that the planning for D-Day was about the same way. I mean, it was planned out, everything. No one knew when it was going to be. In fact, I didn't even know what it was going to be. And I was set up initially to do the property when they got over to to the new institution. But the individual they was going to have do the control center, for some reason, I guess was out sick or something like that. So they decided that I was going to go into the control center that day. And I was working day shift, and they called me and they said, be in here tomorrow morning at 4:00. And once they said that, I knew what it was. And I walked in at 4:00 in the morning, and there was a CO1 on control center on for morning watch. And I told the individual, I said, I'm your relief. And he looked at it, and she looked at me like, you're what? I said, I'm your relief. And it was like, by then, you know, I was like, okay. Yeah, it got started, and it was... Once we got started, they had the buses would leave, and they had them all blocked off from the moment they left that back gate of MSP to the moment they got to JCCC. They didn't stop. Between JCPD, Highway Patrol, they had all the roads blocked off. They would have a Highway Patrol, or at that time C-Star, vehicle in the front, one in the back.
Sure.
They had the Highway Patrol helicopter. Was overhead all the time, and once they would start, they would roll out, and then they were loading up another one, and it was just a continuous chain. And I was on the, you know, like I said, doing all the chronos, and you know, I get bus so and so left, arrived at JCCC, left with 33, arrived with 33, and we went through the whole thing. And like I said, it took a long time to do that. It was like 1,300 inmates that they moved out of there that day.
Okay.
And Mr. Dormar, who was the
most of them high security.
All of them. All
most
all
of them high security. Five. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Mr. Dormar took the inmate had been there the longest. He took him over there. He transported him over there at last in his car. And we had to wait until they cleared the count. Over at JCCC, you know, they cleared the count. And then once the count was cleared up until that moment, we still had 15 officers in the towers. We still had all the weapons in the towers. And Mr. Schreiber was there with Major Boyd. And they called down and told me to go ahead and tell the tower officers they could go ahead and remove all the weapons and everything and unman the towers. And this was my 5 seconds most of fame. Everybody says 15. I don't know how long it was, but I made the last radio transmission from MSP, and no one really knew what I was going to say until the time. And you know, basically, I said, "Station one to all Missouri State Penitentiary officers and to all Missouri Department of Corrections institution. Missouri State Penitentiary is now 10-7." The call signs Station 1 and the call letters KI 250 now belong to Station 1. This is Missouri State Senate Penitentiary signing off the radio the last time. KAI 250. And that was it. And you didn't hear nothing on the radio for a little while. And then all of a sudden, the individual that was over at JCCC, he picked up on it. And he said, Station 1 to all, you know, it's basically the same thing. He says, JCCC is now 10-6. Uh-huh. And then that's how it ended.
Wow.
You know, so.
Yeah.
It was like 7 o'clock at night before we did it. So it's a long day.
Well, that KAI 250 that you saying that just brought back memories. You know, that's pretty cool. And it's cool that you got to do that. That is your 5 seconds of fame there.
Yeah, about basically 5 seconds. Everybody says 15, but it didn't take me that long, you know, how to do that. But, in fact,
the other thing I'm thinking about.
Go ahead.
I was going to say the other thing I'm thinking about is I can't imagine being a tower officer that day and just leaving the tower. That's so foreign to even think about. That had to have been hard for those guys.
It was, you know, I mean, like I said, you know, here you are, you know, you're up there, you've got a 38, you've got a 12 gauge, and you got an M, or at that time, AR-15, and, you know, you're sitting there, you know, you're still clearing your tower every 10 minutes, and then you receive the call. It was like, okay, go ahead, and they're going to start coming around, you know, make sure you got all ammunition and that, and check it off, and take all the weapons into the armory, and that's it. You know, and then they basically left them that shift there the rest of the night, you know, to kind of clean things up a little bit and everything. And then the next shift, morning watch, reported to the new institution. So
that's crazy.
It was a little bit different. You know, everybody was always asking about, you know, were you ever scared or did you ever have any weird feelings? I know there are some people who said, you know, about ghosts and everything like that. I don't know if I'd say scaredest, but the strangest feeling I ever had at that institution was after it closed. The major called me and he said, hey, I need you to go down to 5C and I want you to check on something for me because, you know, they wanted to make sure something didn't get left down there. So I said, okay, no problem. So I went to the institution, came in because they had a couple of people that were doing like, you know, just watching it. And I walk in, and you're walking down and walking back behind food service and industries and all that, and it's dead quiet. It's like you're walking in a ghost town. I mean, absolutely nothing. The week before, it was just constant noise and yelling and screaming, and all of a sudden, it's just nothing. And it's like, where's all the noise? Where's everything? And then, to make matters worse, I get down to 5C, which was a so what they called Supermax AdSeg, and I get down there, and the door had been propped open a little bit. So I pull the door open. About the time I pull the door open, one of those damn feral cats jump out at the doorway, screaming at me.
Yeah.
They get locked up in there, you know, like, and like, darn near lost it then, you know. So, but then, you know, like I said, it's just one of those things. It was weird. And after I got done with 5C, I walked down through industries, dead quiet. You know, I mean, it was like, you know, like you ever see the television show where the guy's walking through a ghost town. That's what it was like. And then so that was a weird feeling. So
that's crazy. You know, for years, in order to pass the time sometimes, or it was kind of cathartic for me, I would write little stories or I would write poems. And, I wrote one about a day that I spent in the, in one of the towers. And, I'm going to go to the book here real quick. And, so perched 30 feet above the prison yard in a stone tower built before the turn of the century, I watch over the repetitive lives of the men below me. A shotgun leans heavily against my leg and the click, click, click of an ancient steel fan hypnotizes me as it blows hot summer air across my face. The tension in the air drips like molasses today, and I notice that the yard is quiet, too quiet. I scan intently for what's interrupted the normal deafening roar of male voices. A glint of steel in the sunlight catches my eye. No noise, just clustered motion. I try to notice who had the knife, but it is lost in a sea of stone-chiseled faces that have all done the same thing. Like gawkers at a car wreck, the inmates gather around one inmate who's left lying in the pool of crimson blood, turning sticky in the July heat. I see in many of the faces a desire to help, but every inmate knows that to do so would show weakness and target them next. Arriving all at once, the yard comes alive with officers pouring out of the shadows and doors like programmed robots, unaware of the danger. I chamber around into the barrel of my shotgun. The distinctively sharp sound echoes across the yard, and the crowd of inmates step back to give the officers room. Putting the injured on the stretcher, the officers carry him off the yard like an injured football player. Splatters of dark blood are left to form an uneven pool that will stay until the next rainstorm washes the concrete clean again. This one will not die. His blood will fertilize the growing hate that smothers this place. He will be patched up and take his revenge another day. The noise returns cautiously. The tension in the air fades. I adjust my duty belt and return to the long periods of monotony that are punctuated by these moments of complete chaos. And that's what I think about, and that's what I see when I remember working those old towers over that yard.
I would tell people that 99% of the time it was fairly uneventful. But that 1%, mm-hmm. when all hell broke loose, you paid for that other 99%. I mean, you're talking about staff
absolutely
coming out of the woodwork. You know, you'd hear a 1049, you'd see, several officers running, 1050. And if somebody ever called a 105, mm-hmm. which is officer that needs assistance, you'd be like, damn, I didn't know we have that many people working that day. You know, there would be people from everywhere. Yeah. I mean, you had to really watch, like I said, when we were a sergeant or something in the housing unit, you had to make sure that not everybody took off. You'd have everybody wanting to take off, and then it's like, whoa. We got to have somebody back here. We got to have somebody to run the housing unit. But everybody and their brother would empty out of all those housing units and respond. It was a different. It still is today.
Definitely a different place. So did you go over to JCC, Jefferson City Correctional Center? Is that where you went next?
I transferred over. Well, of course, everybody transferred over there. And it was a little bit different over there because at MSP, if you were a housing unit officer, I could tell you what keys you would need, or I'd tell you how to sling the levers. I knew everything pretty much over there at that old place. I get to JCCC, uh-huh. and I'm just like, I know absolutely nothing about that. How to this use that switchboard and everything to open up the cells. And I'd be in the house, and you'd, hey, Captain, can you open that cell? I ain't touching it. I was like, you show me how to do this. As before, it was like I had to show them. It was a different learning curve because they were the ones that knew how to run it. And I didn't. It took a little bit, but it wasn't that complicated. Right. But it was just one of those. It was a different learning curve, And, of course, difference, in the whole thing, over there at MSP, you want a key, you went up to the round gate, and you told them what key you need, and you handed them a little chip. Over there at the new institution, everything was computerized. You went up to a panel, and you punched in your code and what key you wanted, and the thing would pop open, a little light, and you pull that key out, and then you could run a report, and it'd tell you who had what key was still out and everything. And MSP, you had a count and check, and, it was completely different mm-hmm. to the best. I mean, it was a lot better. I mean, there were so many different things that we had there that we didn't have at the old place, so. But once I got there as a captain, then it's kind of one of those things that some things just kind of, I'm not sure whether they fell into my lap or how it would happen or whatever you want to call it, was there was a couple things that I got to do that benefited me even more. Was there was one, I got selected to be on a committee to write the emergency plans for the department. And there was several of us that got started out. Okay. And then eventually caught down to there was like about five of us that were there all the time. And I was the lowest ranking person, you know, there on it, you know, as a captain. But yet, you know, whenever we had the committee, what was great about it was my opinion would matter just as much as the, you know, this other person. And I really, you know, it was another thing. I learned a lot about how to, you know, the emergency plans worked, you know, the National Incident Command System and everything. And it was something else that helped further my career. In fact, one time they were doing we had to do like an emergency drill, and I was on evening shift, and evening shift was the one that was getting ready to do it. So we did it and everything. And the fire and safety manager from central office was there, and we got all done and everything. And, you know, I mean, I'm going through it just like bam, bam, bam. And we got all done, and he made the comment, was like, "Well, you knew the emergency plans like you wrote them." And the one individual was on the committee with me. She started to laugh and says, "Yeah, he did." So right. That was, you know, but later on, you know, I kept, when I made major and I went down to South Central, then I was able to take what I learned from there and try to, you know, bring up different things and try to improve on it. You know, so like I said, that was different. You know, it was like a year of my life that was spent doing that, but it was well worth it, you know? So,
Did you activate South Central?
No, I had South Central. It had been up and running. You know, there had been several majors that had been there. South Central opened up, I think, before JCCC did. So, you know, it had been up and running by that time. So, it was one of those things that, you know, I had the opportunity to go down there and for promotion, and it was like, yeah, I'm going to take it, you know, even though I'd rather stayed at the other place, but I had to, you know, go where I needed to go for the promotion. And I enjoyed it down there. It was completely different, and had a good warden down there that was fortunate that let me do my job. So,
yeah. So what, you went from correctional officer all the way to the highest custody, which is chief of custody, major. What's the one thing you take away from that career? What did you learn over those years?
There was a lot of different things. You know, a lot of it goes back to what I said before, was there'd be times like, you know, when I was a captain, even later, you know, I'd be going around to the housing units, and I'd get in the housing units, and we'd just get start talking. And we could talk about anything. We would talk about, sometimes we'd be there, like, where to go on vacation. Well, I went to this place, or we'd get talking about anything from cooking to canning. And I got it to where, you know, I'd get into the housing units, and then that was just, you know, get talking with the staff. And then that's how I build the rapport and got the respect of the staff, just by talking and listening to them. And then again, it's the major. So the whole thing of it was, it boils down to, you have to go ahead and be able to talk and listen to people, try to do as much as you can for them. And it boiled down to just respect. If they respected you, I mean, they're today, I'll run around, I'll be going someplace, and I'll run into somebody that worked for me. And, you know, they'll make the comment about, you know, like, we really appreciated, you know, what, you know, you listening to us. And it just really makes you feel good that, you know, that these people still kind of remember you and what you were like and what your leadership. And I try to pass that on. You know, a lot of them were different leadership aspects. A lot of the people that worked for me eventually had made captain too. In fact, one of them had worked as me as a CO1 sergeant, lieutenant, and he didn't work for me as captain, but he's now a major, you know. So, you know, I kind of look at it, you know, it's right. Like, okay, did I have any impact on it? I'm hoping I had impact on some of these people, but, you know, it's just,
right.
You know, you just want to make sure that somewhere along the line you have left some kind of a legacy with people, you know, and,
yeah,
I guess that's it. You want to make sure your legacy is still out. 30.
Absolutely.
30 plus.
30 years total?
Yeah. 30 years and a few months.
Okay.
Well, people always ask me at first, you know, how's retirement? And I said, I just miss dealing with the people, you know, with the officers, with the inmates, just the day-to-day functions of it. Whenever I used to go on vacation, and we'd come back from vacation, I'd always have, you know, we'd always sit down and always tell them about, you know, what we did on vacation and everything. And when I was down in Licking as the major, you know, my secretary and the policy and procedure coordinator who was across the hall from us, we'd sit down there, a cup of coffee, and, you know, and I'd for about a half hour or so, I'd just tell them what we did on vacation and everything. And the day after I retired, we went on a vacation. We went to Washington, D.C., and we went to Mount Vernon and Monticello, places like that. And we came back, and the only person I had to talk to about my vacation was my wife, and it was like, well, she ain't no fun because she was there with me. So I didn't have anybody to talk to.
She was there.
Yeah, she was there. So, you know, it's just the dealing with the people. I mean, you know, you dealt with people actually, you know, pretty much for 40 some years, I dealt with people in one form or another with, you know, either as in, you know, in the military, as a, you know, I was an E-7 in the military, so I was a platoon sergeant and a drill sergeant, so you dealt with people. And then when you got in corrections, you dealt with people. So you're constantly dealing with people, you know, all the time. And then all of a sudden, it just stops and you don't have nothing. Now, once I got out, before I got out, I'd got into the Missouri Corrections Association, and I got to be on the board of directors because we had one of our deputy wardens, Donna Kerr, she wanted me to get on it. So I got on it, and of course, Donna's no longer with us, but you know, eventually now I became vice president of the board, and I got two more years left as vice president, and then I'll probably pass it on to somebody else, you know, so that somebody newer, starting younger to get into it, you know.
We got to talk during the conference, but for people that don't know, tell them about, you know, what the Missouri Correctional Association's about, what you're trying to do, and, you know, how they can get involved.
Well, a lot of people, we was trying to get some of the sheriff's departments in it, and they think we're part of Missouri Department of Corrections. The Missouri Corrections Association actually falls under the umbrella of the American Corrections Association. And if you join the American Corrections Association, it's a dual membership. You'd be automatically become a member of Missouri Corrections Association. And it's just support of correctional staff to support the thin gray line. The ACA has their conferences, their conferences are so much bigger than ours. You know, I mean, you know, ours, we have, you know, maybe 150, 200 people. I mean, there, they'll have several hundred people. And the idea is just to try to get out classes, try to get out some information. A lot of it is to try to get other people to talk, to do networking. ACA has been around for years. ACA actually has classes that you can take through ACA. You know, like I said, they have different things that they offer. They used to put out a magazine a lot, but now they've went to everything else that has gone into though you can get it online, you know, you get your newspaper or newsletter or whatever online.
Sure.
And again, they try to keep getting the information out concerning new and improved changes and corrections. Whenever COVID was hitting, they had quite a bit of information coming out on COVID and dealing with COVID and corrections and stuff like that.
Yeah.
MCA, you know, like I said, we try to have the classes to where we have different things. We have different speakers come in each year. We try to have it to where, you know, people can kind of get away from the job, but yet not from the job. In other words, it gives them an opportunity to meet with other people and talk with other people. And, you know, in some cases, some things happen, you know, really off the cuff. You know, you just meet somebody and it's like all of a sudden, you know, you start talking and they might say something like, well, I really like that idea. And, you know, I always looked at it, you know, if you copied somebody else's procedure or plan or something like that, it wasn't plagiarism. It was just good paperwork, you know.
Right.
Yeah. You know, so it's just one of those, like I said, trying to, you know, keep people informed of it and everything like that. And
yeah, I was going to say, I was impressed with the vendors that were there. And, you know, the technology that's out there, and you got to kind of handle that, and they showed you how it worked, and there was some pretty neat stuff there.
Well, we had one time, one vendor came in, and he had handheld metal detectors, and they were different than the ones that we currently have. We needed some new ones down at Licking, so I ordered a couple of them. And they had a lot of other features that the ones we didn't have. And one of the officers was walking along the yard. And he just had it on and just hanging down his side, just swinging it back and forth. And he's walking through the grass, and all of a sudden it went off. And he's like, okay. So they stopped and thought it'd be something. So they dug it up, and it turned out to be the foil packet from a cigarette pack. And it picked it up from about 18 inches off the ground.
Wow.
So that was one of those things that, you know, it was just so much better than anything that we had. And then a lot of other institutions, you know, I talked to some of the other majors, and some of them got it. And that was just one of those things that just happened to be. He was one of our vendors. And, you know, like that was one of the things. This year we had the majors from all the institutions had a majors meeting there. And we got them to go talk to all the vendors. And I asked all of them as they were leaving. And there was a lot of them said, yeah, I told this vendor I wanted him at my institution because what they had, we could really use. And so it's just one of those things that, you know, I always believe in the power of one. If one person can make the difference, or one thing can make the difference in how something is run or how something is done, then it was well worth it. You know,
sure.
One of the things that we had there was we passed out every year. It was those heirs of restraint, which is a corrections officer Bible. And that was kind of one of those different things I ran into. I was at a grocery store, and I was in uniform coming home from work. And this individual, she walked up to me and she said, thank you for your service. And I'm thinking like, well, how did you know I was in the military? And I said something. She says, no. She says, thank you for being in corrections. Well, her husband had worked for the one of the county jails, and they started this program. And then I got talking to them, and then that's how I managed to get these Bibles. And they put them out on their own, and then we get them and try to pass them out and then get them to the institutions. So,
well, John, I think we we covered a lot of territory there. I appreciate it. Thanks
no
for coming on the podcast today.
Okay, I hope I didn't ramble too much.
Oh, no. No, that was a great conversation. Okay. A lot of people are going to enjoy that. I will put the links in the show notes for the Missouri Correctional Association. Matter of fact, I'll look up the heirs to restraint links, and I'll put that down there, too, for those that might be interested in contacting those people. But Thank you. I appreciate you coming on. Welcome. Oh, go ahead.
You're very much welcome. He has a really good website. He's got a lot of information that's on there in addition to not only the Bible, and he does all that on his own. So it's very impressive what he does.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, we'll get a link up there so that people can see that. Hey, till next time, I appreciate it, and you have a great day.
You too, sir. Thank you.
I would like to take a minute to thank one of our sponsors that make the Prison Officer Podcast possible. Omni RTLS is a company that I've been working with for the last year. I am proud to be part of this team of correctional professionals who have developed the best real-time locating system on the market today. With Omni's real-time location technology, you automatically know the accurate locations and interactions of all inmates, staff, and assets anywhere in your correctional facility, and you have this information in real time. Omni is cutting-edge software for today's jails and prisons. It is the only way to monitor every square inch of your facility while still being PREA compliant. Go to www.omnirtls for more information and to make your facility safer today. That's www.omnirtls.com. If you enjoy these podcasts, the best way to support the Prisoner Officer Podcast is to share these episodes with your friends or family on social media. Let me invite you to visit www.theprisonofficer.com. If you haven't already, check out the Prison Officer Podcast on Facebook and click that little follow button, or leave us a message, or better yet, leave us a review. And if you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, Google, or Spotify, please click the subscribe button. Till next time, I'm Mike Cantrell. Watch your back, and please take care of each other out there behind those walls.